Testing, 1, 2.
We are at the Brzezinski trip.
Right, and I think we're still in Tokyo.
That's right.
You had talked about the...
some of the tensions.
Tensions in the preparation.
In the preparation, and right.
And I had talked about my discussion was big, and the Muska was there in the restaurant. When he was quite adamant about there should only be the three of us, you and I, and along with himself, in the important meetings in Peking. Then we took the plane on the morning of the 20th to go to Peking. And I was sitting up forward with the Brzezinskis. Bill Gleistein came by and said if I had a chance, he'd just like to chat with me. So I went back to talk to him. And he said he was in a very difficult situation because, as I remember it, it had been proposed to him that he join us in lieu of Holbrook, and that he just couldn't do that to Dick, he said. But it really, really put him in the middle. This conversation took a little time, maybe 15, 20 minutes. And then Holbrook came back to join us. He was really quite upset. My memory is not clear whether he was told at that juncture that Zbig was willing to accept Bill Gleistein. I think so. He, of course, took the line that Bill should go, although I doubt if there's much sincerity in it, maybe. But Bill was, it would be improper, unseemly. And then I tended to support Bill. After a while, Zbig came by and made some wisecracks, and that, of course, ended it. In that regard, jumping forward a bit.
Zbig was, I might just say more on his conduct on that trip, too. Zbig, I think, just enjoyed humiliating Dick. There was an element of that.
What
in addition to the issue.
What I'm about to say fits into that because, as you remember, you all stayed out at guest house number 5 out in the Western Complex, the Ayutthaya. And one morning, whether this would have been, I think, this, probably the second day, Sharon was out there and was at the breakfast time, was having coffee with Muska at a table. And, this was after the meeting with Deng Xiaoping. So it had to be either the Monday morning, the 22nd, or the 23rd, which was the day of departure. I think it was the 22nd. And, Zbig comes in and he's full of high spirits, and he says there's another table where staff people were there, and he said, among other things, this is stuck with Sharon's memory, presenting Holbrook's head on a platter to the Chinese. But then there's a sequel to it. If you remember, maybe you didn't notice, But the Chinese, after the meeting with Deng, when Holbert was left out, began to downgrade him. In the motorcade, he was, his car, the car to which he was signed, was several down. And just about this happened on two occasions, including the day of departure. Just as before we started, he would run up to our car, which was in his normal place, and can I ride with you? And of course, we said yes. So on the day of departure, which was the morning of the 23rd of May, he's in the car, and Sheriff, and she's been mortified about this ever since, thinking it was just an in-house joke, tells him what's big and done. To which he made absolutely no response, thank heaven. It wasn't until after the party was gone that I said, I told her that was not a joke. This is a matter about which the poor man feels very deeply.
Well, it had a, there was an element to it that perhaps neither Sharon nor you do at the time. On the plane ride, I remember Big going over to Dick and starting to berate not just Dick, but a number of the assistant secretaries at that point. And then he told Dick, I think the president ought to fire a number of the assistant secretaries. That's what I've been encouraging him for some time. Dick was fighting for his, from his perspective, I suspect, fighting for his political life. Hence, what I mentioned to you last time, that he did not wish, let me put it positively, he wished to be the person to brief Vance on the trip. But Big was determined to deny him the capacity to do the briefing of Vance, and hence the president.
Yes, well,
rough stuff.
As you remember, we had two meetings with Huang Hua in the late afternoon of the day of arrival, the Saturday, and resumed after the visit to the Mao Memorial on the Sunday morning. How would you characterize those meetings?
It was a monologue, the first one by Brzezinski, which he gave a total presentation of American foreign policy, our perception of the Soviet Union, and the weapon systems that we were developing. Do you remember?
Yes.
And it was calculated to be a rebuttal to Chinese misperceptions of Prim 10 and of Carter administration weakness.
Now, my memory of it is Wang Hua was tended to be a little scornful of the presentation. Am I wrong in that? On that aspect of it, let me put it differently. Very questioning of were we in fact taking a strong position.
Yes, although I thought Zbig spoke for a longer period of time than he needed. But as I look back on it, I think that he made his point. And he made his point by the end. And you will remember the other part that he built into his presentation was what we thought the Chinese ought to be doing in Africa, in the Middle East, in Japan, with Japan and the Peace and Friendship Treaty. And I think you're right that Huang Hua is scornful, but I think he's scornful of many things. I think that the impact...
His style, in some degree.
I think Zbig's presentation had its intended impact in two regards. First, it may have helped encourage Huang Hua to take his trip to Africa soon thereafter. Not to take it, but to commit himself as much to Mobutu as he had. You remember, soon went on. I don't know whether, maybe that's even giving Zbig more credit than he's due, but but I we what we did when I got back to Washington was make a list of all of these items that we had indicated to the Chinese they could do something on and that we would be watching them. And the fact is that their record over the next 5 months as we negotiated normalization was fairly impressive on that list.
Mm-hmm. Well, Vance, in a more tentative way, had raised the same questions about it seems possible that you might do this, that, and the other, to which, of course, they were completely non-responsive. They just ignored it. And then the welcoming banquet, I thought the mood was very good. They didn't quite have the highlights of the farewell banquet two nights later. Then the meeting with Deng Xiaoping, I thought was... Big made an excellent presentation there. It was very strong and forceful without being obnoxious in any way. The president has made up his mind, not if he makes up his mind. And, I think he made a very considerable impression on the vice premier. Is that your feeling?
Yes. To me was one of the most skillful sessions of diplomacy that I experienced while I was in the U.S. government. I think Mondale was also of that same level, but I saw no others. But Zbigniew, you will remember, spoke without any notes.
Yes.
It was a total conversation. And I went over the transcript many times afterward. I'm not sure that he even was conscious of what he was doing, but I remember listening and realizing what had begun to unfold. This was not a normal negotiating session. It was a genuine conversation. And Zbig turned it into that when Deng first asked him, I believe, about the world situation. And he said, I will answer that question in a minute, but I want to first talk about our bilateral relationship. And then he made a presentation, very brief, about normalization and why it was important, and then said, I know I'm not answering your question, but it seems to me that one can't answer your broader question without addressing the normalization issue. And then he answered the question, and from then on, the conversation wove between the bilateral and the global strategic, and they would edge into the sensitive parts of the bilateral relationship, the Taiwan question, and always went immediately racing back to the global strategic, where there was shared agreement, so that one could extract oneself from what would be the most contentious issues. Deal with those contentious issues in an amiable fashion.
It was a very skillful performance. Did you see the letter that I sent to the president?
No.
And carried back?
No.
He asked if I would...
Oh, yes, of course I did, because I asked you to write it. But I knew it.
He asked me.
But I knew he had asked you.
Right.
That's right.
And then the dinner at Bay High, we walked right from the meeting at the Great Hall to Bay High Park to the Fangshan restaurant. And the atmosphere there was very much the same as the atmosphere that Vance had it out of the Summer Palace, very warm and relaxed. Remember the discussions about what had happened to some of the old Bolsheviks. And impression as big as Muska seemed to have, that he was a pretty tough old character, that if you had to eliminate somebody physically, that was just part of the game. But my other memory of that is that it was a small gathering. We were in not a big room, the biggest room in the Fangshan, but it's not a big room. So it was a limited audience. And Deng's hearing that night was the worst, I think, of any time I've ever seen him. And he had to keep telling his interpreter to speak up. So that the whole room would fall silent to hear the translation.
Ji Chaoju was doing translating, wasn't he, or was it Madame Shun?
Madam
no,
Shun.
G was not anywhere there. I'm totally wrong. Madame
Shun.
Sure. Shi Yanhua.
Madame Shun.
Shi Yanhua.
Right, sure.
And Nancy Tong was still around, wasn't she? We could look that up in the record.
Yes.
I think Nancy Tong did.
I have no memory of her being at that dinner, but she was still around at that point. Definitely.
That's a good question. Who attended this big session on the Chinese side with Deng Xiaoping? You and I accompanied this big. Who accompanied Deng?
We should check that.
Huang Hua,
certainly.
It's in my picture. I have a picture of the session.
The
Wang Hairong?
I think she was there. It seems to me they had four or five.
Lien Zhengbao did the note-taking, I remember.
Well, when I say four or five, I'm
on the side.
I mean, apart from the note-taker
yes.
and the interpreter. Because we had sort of expected it would be three and three. And I think Wang Hairong was there because Dick took great note of that, the fact that she was there and he was excluded. But it would be well to check the
One other
picture.
Thing about, and again, because this is a record for many years hence, you were last session with Deng Xiaoping on December 15th, in which you talked about arms sales. Echoed Deng of Big's own discussion about what would happen after normalization. And I think that's worth noting. You will remember that Big discussed our entering a transitional era,
right,
in which history would take its course on the Taiwan issue. That was done extemporaneously, and the phrase transitional era, I've never asked Big where it came from, but he may have mulled over it beforehand or not, but I raise this because I am hesitant to see you totally out on a limb for the formulation of December 15th, and I don't quite know how to handle that part of the negotiating record, but you're carrying a heavier burden at this point, it seems to me, than you probably should be.
Well, things are changing. You know, the editorial of the LA Times had just a few weeks ago, in which they said, in effect said, the relationship of China and the U.S. is so important that no arms sales to Taiwan, which they don't need, should take place that endangers that relationship.
Right.
That couldn't possibly have happened
exactly.
4 years ago.
No, but you understand what I mean.
Yes.
That at the present time, I was present at one meeting where someone said, well, look, at the one thing that's on the record is what Woodcock said, and I said, look, that is not accurate. But and that Big did have that phrasing in his discussion with Dunn, which is exactly the same, and it is an accurate statement.
It's an accurate statement. It's an absolute fact that all things begin to change.
That's right.
But they don't change overnight.
That's right.
And what's carrying forward the myth of Taiwan is the old ideologues who unfortunately won the election. But the reality of the situation is tempering even the most prominent ideologue, namely the man who's now president of the United States.
Right. Well, I'm encouraging Zbig in his memoirs to float that.
Then on the next day after that dinner, we went to the Great Wall.
I did not go.
Oh, you didn't go?
No.
Where Zbig gave a very impressive physical performance, athletic performance. Wong Hyrum was there, so she must have been at the meeting the night before. That's when he said, what was it, the ratio to the top, the first one there gets to...
Fight the polar bear.
Fight the polar bear in Afghanistan. And then...
Did he say in Afghanistan?
That's what I think.
Is that right? I don't remember the in Afghanistan.
It would have been prophetic if it had been.
Yeah.
But maybe that's coming to my memory is by by what happened later. Of course, this is May 78.
The coup had already taken
place the month before.
And I remember Zbig talking about it.
Yes, put great emphasis.
That was part of his presentation,
right.
Put great emphasis
right.
on it.
I think he did say in Afghanistan. And then I didn't go all the way to the top. And he comes running down. There was a group of Chinese naval cadets who were having their picture taken, so he joins the group. Wouldn't they like to have their picture taken with the leading polar bear baiter in the United States? And then, of course, we had the meeting with Wong Wofeng.
Well, he was just like a little kid. He remember, the ground rule is he had a press person with him. One ground rule was no conversations, only pictures. And, of course, that he was naive to think...
This was one of the press group that had come with him.
Yeah, only one came up to the Great Wall. Only one came, but for pictures. And for nothing else other than pictures. But it was an AFP man, I think. And he then quoted Zbig. And it really damaged the trip. Those lines hurt.
Because it's the kind of story that gets a lot of attention, far more than it's worth.
That's right.
I must say that my hair kind of stood on end.
I actually encouraged him not to go out there. I wanted his original itinerary, you remember, was to go to Peking University. You may not remember that. And go and to be with intellectuals. I thought he might have another chance to come to China and make the Great Wall, but that he should presage the frank press trip by indicating that we were really interested. But he came out of those talks so exhilarated
that
he was not about to be disciplined.
He
knew he'd done a great job and he wanted to enjoy it.
He was so vibrant that day. He was so much enjoying it. You're absolutely right. Then the meeting with Wong Wofeng. That was the one session in which I was somewhat impressed with Wong.
Mm-hmm. We were too.
Because when Zbig was making his response, as I remember it, he broke in on four or five occasions to make comment. And the comments clearly indicated he was keeping abreast of the foreign developments. Whereas the time I had seen him with Vance, just recited a monologue that he could just have learned, and I think would have just continued it, got up and said goodbye, and the feds hadn't broken in on him. That was, I think, also the first time I saw him with his habit, which he developed later by tucking the leg under himself and twisting around.
That's so he could establish direct eye contact with the
right, and it also, I think, emphasized the fact that he was younger than his Chinese colleagues. That's an impression I got from it. Because you would see this on the Chinese television. They always had that shot. But he was quite impressive in that meeting.
Did you see the report that Brzezinski sent to the president on his trip, including his discussion of Hua Guofeng? Because that's what I drafted for Zbing on the way back. But we evaluated Hua's performance highly, and that he looked like, particularly, he had grown so from the prior sessions that one thought maybe he was a person to be reckoned with.
I shared that feeling at that time.
I guess in retrospect, it was the apex of his rule. He had had the economic targets behind him, the NPC. Maybe he had reconciled some of his differences with Doug.
Had he been on his trip at that point?
No, that
that came later. That same summer.
Same summer, that's right. The Romania trip came later in the year.
It was after that that he made his speech about we can do better than the targets we have set. Look what Japan did in just 13 years. So we can do much more than we have. I think it was at that point he overstretched himself and the ground began to dissolve underneath him.
Right. He became perceived as really a great leap forward type.
Right.
He upped the targets for steel at that point over his early 78 targets.
Yes. And they were fantastic targets, calling for 60 million metric tons at a time when the production was, I remember, it was barely 23 million. That's right. It was fantasy compounded at that point. Then the return banquet was a very convivial affair. The exuberance of our side, with one notable exception. And I must say that at the table, Muska was almost savage in her baiting of Dick Holbrook. He came very disheveled, and she made caustic comment about that. Then, of course, she gave a second toast on the American side. I had my heart in my mouth for a few minutes, but she carried it off
very
well.
Nice,
very well.
Very well. But you remember that Zbig started his toast with a poem by Chairman Mao, which he had not given to the Chinese beforehand.
And
he just picked it out.
The Chinese interpreter looked very bad.
Oh, that was so embarrassing.
Yeah, that was very bad.
Very embarrassing.
Because she fumbled, you remember.
Someone else had to go.
And then the audience began to say it for her.
That's right.
And she was so embarrassed.
She didn't know Chairman Mao's poem.
Yeah.
I saw her. She did not do much translating after that. Isn't that right?
I don't think she did, though.
But I saw her at the Trilateral Commission, and she's doing well, and I had a talk about that. I asked her, in fact, whether that had
gotten What did she say about it?
No. And that, in fact, she translated, but that she told me she was promoted, that she has more line responsibility.
That's good. And then the party departed, and it was a very worthwhile, very productive visit. And I think came at a critical time in the developments on the Chinese side. And I think that Dong was getting a surer place, and the other developments, Yemeni murders hadn't taken place yet. They came very shortly after. But the coup in Afghanistan had taken place. And,
well, the Horn, much
the
more.
The Horn was developing
the Somali,
very badly from
that
our,
was,
our point
that
of
was
view,
crucial.
Right.
And
the
we, a pincer operation, a pincer a concern for the Horn coupled with Yemen was already evident, but you're right about the assassinations, but I think that the vulnerability of the Horn and ultimately on Saudi Arabia was already beginning to be evident.
Yeah, well, South Yemen, of course, before the assassinations was without question in the Soviet orbit, so it was already a threat in that sense. But the Horn going as badly as it did, particularly in Eritrea, as well as the Ogaden.
And then Zbig's visit coincided with the incursion into Zaire from Angola. The last thing that he did before he departed Washington was to put together a package through the NSC mechanisms of France and others going to Mobutu's assistance. And that was one of the leading presentations then on the situation in Zaire.
And the days following, I spent a lot of time with my ambassadorial colleagues, particularly from the NATO countries and those who were most interested in what was going on. And I note on the right after that, I received a farewell call from the USSR ambassador Tolstikov, who was leaving after 7.5 years and was extremely glad to go. Then I noticed that at the end of May, my calendar says I was ill for 3 days. Let me jump a bit ahead of this. I had had a tubercular history as a young man when I'd been. This is the days before drugs had been developed to combat the tuberculosis bacillus. And, where I was essentially bed rest, except I'd had a phrenectomy, which was supposed to be temporary, where the phrenic nerve is crushed and it lifts the diaphragm. Then that's supposed to restore itself when it's a temporary, and then the diaphragm resumes its normal place. But the temporary had become permanent, so that all of those years I have an elevated lung, in essence only a quarter of a lung on that side. And I'd had a recurrence of the TB problem in 1969, but this was readily handled because now the development of drugs, so that periodically, I'd get knocked out. I'd get very cold, and I'd have a raging fever, and it used to last 24, 36 hours. This particular one was a little worse than normal and lasted almost 72 hours. And then I noticed, again, I got another bout in 4 or 5 weeks. Well, by this time, and again, a third one from this point right after the first negotiating session on the 5th of July. Well, very frankly, I was mentally fighting that this is the TB has come back again, and that if I have a medical examination, that means I have to leave this place at this what seemed to be a very promising and exciting time. Sharon really read the riot act to me, that I had absolutely no right to engage in these negotiations, on these critical negotiations on behalf of the United States, if at some juncture I suddenly am knocked out and can't attend an absolutely necessary meeting. I had to agree with her, grudgingly, but I had to agree with her, and in August, after the third negotiating session, made arrangements to go to the naval hospital at Yokosuka and had a very thorough exam by the head of the clinical services. I was there 3 days or so. And the diagnosis was that no, I had no tubercular problem. But the fact that my lung was so elevated that it wasn't performing the normal function of rejecting certain things, and so the viruses would accumulate, and I'd get these quite brief, but nevertheless, bouts that would knock me out. And actually, with some very simple regimen, I was able to overcome it and haven't had any problems since. But I must say that I probably would have kept putting it off if it hadn't been for Sharon's stern insistence. But she sat me down and appealed to my patriotic sense of duty. It was very helpful. Then in June, Doug Fraser and a small group came from the UIW as our personal guests. I had asked the Chinese if he could meet with some trade union representatives. And the best they could come up with was some local person who would be at the level of a committeeman. And of course, at this point, they did not have their trade union. The All China Trade Union Federation was not back in operation. They didn't have their first Congress since the Cultural Revolution until October of that year. And we rejected the meeting they proposed, and didn't see any trade union people except as we visited certain factories. And asked about it, we'd at least be able to talk to the local trade union representative. Part of that delegation was my former secretary then and now Fraser's secretary, Mary Wenzel, who speaks Russian. When Tolstikov gave his farewell reception on the 7th of June, we took her along. And as we go through the receiving line, introduce her, and she speaks to them in Russian. Of course, they were delighted. And Mrs. Tolstikov, when the receiving line broke up, came and sought her out and talked to her at considerable length to tell her they were not going to Moscow. They were going to Leningrad. There was only one place to go, and that was Leningrad. And she it was who observed that after the formal toast, which Tolstikov had given to the assembled group, to where he said the things protocol demanded, he then went through with greeting small groups and individuals, and his translator was saying that he is saying how sad he is to leave this beautiful country, or worse to that effect. He said he's not saying that at all. He's saying how glad I am to get out of this awful place, and how great it will be to get back to the Soviet Union. We went with them too to Xi'an. We saw the diggings, but at this point they'd all been covered up because they were beginning to build the superstructure, which you saw when Mondel went there. So that, except for the specimens they had in a small hut, we really saw nothing. But we did go out some 94 kilometers to the tombs of the Empress Wu family, where there is an open tomb, which was very interesting. And we were there a half a day, several hours. And a small group of children attached themselves to us. They were very, very shy. And this was the first time I had seen poorly dressed children in China. They were not in rags, but their clothes were patched, and they were clearly not nearly as well off as the peasant children that you saw close to the big cities. And as the hours wore on, they got less timid with us and would come right up to us. And then on the way back at a place called Xianyang, we visited the tomb of a great general who had been, forget his name, he had died, he'd been killed quite young, 28 or so. But there were, what really struck us, there were blocks of granite around which had carvings on them. If someone had said Henry Moore did these, you would have believed it, because there'd be this is a lion, or this is that, and it was truly the equivalent of modernistic sculpture. Really very, really very impressive.
Now, were you at this point in contact with the State Department concerning the beginning of negotiations? How informed were you about the meetings with President Carter, one meeting in particular, or I guess two, one that I attended, one that I did not? Which began to sort out the strategy for negotiations.
I was kept informed because the reason I remember that is not so much my memory of the fact of the informing, but I discussed with Fraser as much as I could, because I saw a political problem if we succeeded in doing what we hoped to do, a domestic political problem in which he and the UAW, along with others, could be very helpful, so that, yes, I was aware that this was a time of preparation, together with, of course, what Spigot said to me, the month before.